It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new study out of UW finds that areas with more undocumented immigrants have seen their violent crime rates drop since 1990. We'll talk with a researcher about the numbers. First, Illinois' Attorney General says she's filing a lawsuit over air quality standards in southeastern Wisconsin. The challenge could have big implications for the Foxconn plant in Racine County. Governor Scott Walker responded to the news yesterday, raising the possibility of a countersuit.
We've had in the past decade and a half dramatic drops in terms of pollutants here in the state of Wisconsin. And so our employers and our citizens are taking dramatic action. We haven't seen the same thing in the Chicago area. And so I think it might be worth us looking at a countersuit back.
Lee Bergquist is a reporter who covers environmental issues for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. Lee, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob.
Well, at the center of this lawsuit is this recent EPA ruling on air pollution in southeastern Wisconsin. Can you walk us through what the EPA ruled before we get into this new lawsuit?
Well, it's a national rule, and it really applies to largely metropolitan areas around the United States. And in some areas of the country, many of the big industrial cities, they've grappled with smog or ozone pollution for really decades. And over time, the EPA has, after a scientific study, has ratcheted down the allowable emissions. And we're at that juncture again right now.
And the EPA decision said for southeastern Wisconsin, previously they said, okay, our more stringent rules apply to a wider area. And this new ruling from the EPA really narrowed it down to more specific spots. Why did they make that change?
Well, it depends on who you want to believe or who you – it depends. There's really two schools of thought here. Clearly, the EPA was, up until a few months ago, wanted to put all of southeastern Wisconsin, including Racine County, where Foxconn would be located, in a non-attainment area. It would be violating air emissions laws. And the reason why it was doing that is because that's what the data showed. It showed that ozone levels were high. But there was a request by state officials, Governor Walker and the DNR, and business interests here made their case that essentially the region inherits most of its ozone pollution in the summer from Illinois, and so that these areas, instead of being so broadly written, that they should be really shrunk down to just small areas where ozone is been proven to be at an elevated level.
So Wisconsin got the ruling it wanted, or the ruling the governor wanted from the EPA. Now here's Illinois, their Attorney General Lisa Madigan, challenging this. What is she claiming? What's why is she saying she's planning to sue over this?
Well, she's planning to. She has weighed in, and it's all related to Foxconn. She's weighed in on the Foxconn project already. Previously, when the DNR had to make a decision on whether to allow the city of Racine to divert water from Lake Michigan to Mount Pleasant and to Foxconn, in that case, she raised questions about the diversion. She raised questions about wastewater and how it would be treated. And in this suit here, she's raising concerns about emissions from Foxconn and what impact that would have on the health of people. Now, she didn't say if those were Illinois people or Wisconsin people, but she was raising concerns about about health impacts from the emissions from the Foxconn plant.
Talking to Lee Bergquist from the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel over an Illinois-planned lawsuit over an EPA decision that affects southeastern Wisconsin, ultimately could affect the Foxconn plant. And the idea, Lee, is that if that older EPA decision was in place covering all of, as you mentioned, Racine County, that might affect the kind of pollution controls that Foxconn would have to build. Do I have that right?
Yeah, and it gets into the weeds pretty quickly, yeah. But generally speaking, if you're in a in an area that violates ozone standards, in other words, the air pollutants are above that level, then a factory, let's say a new one that's moving in, would have to install the most expensive equipment, regardless of price, to ensure that it is reducing those ozone emissions as much as possible. So it could be a big cost for Foxconn, and the concern of the Walker administration is they've been doing everything they can to ensure that this project is constructed and moves along quickly, and they're concerned about that.
Now, the Governor Walker raised the point that, as you were mentioning earlier, Lee, a lot of the ozone-causing emissions, they say, are coming from places like northern Illinois, along the Lake Michigan coast. There's been some study on that. What do we know about trying to find out the culprit for the creation of ozone in southeastern Wisconsin?
Well, I think that's true. There has been studies that have been going on for years. There's a consortium of states around Lake Michigan that have studied air quality and the movement of air, polluted air, during certain times of the year, like the summer, and it does show that. A large amount of this air, polluted air, does come from Illinois. Just to be clear, though, it's still the people that are living in southeastern Wisconsin who are breathing it. So, I'm not sure if they care if it's Illinois or Wisconsin's.
We have the Great Lakes Water Compact. That's a cooperative deal between states. We don't have a similar thing when it comes to air. That's all left to organizations like the EPA at the federal level, right?
Yes. There is some regulations that that are been moving along for years that would call for more cooperation between states on air emissions issue. But that's what the EPA does. It oversees the ozone rules like this, and hopefully with the idea of ratcheting down air emissions. And they have reduced. They have fallen in the last 20 years. But the standards get stricter because we learn more and more about the science and the impact of ozone on public health.
Now, you mentioned the phrase into the weeds, Lee. I'm sure a court case on this, when this lawsuit gets filed, will be complicated. It'll take a long time. I won't ask you to predict how it'll come out, but it seems likely that this case would be going on as Foxconn is building, is doing construction, right? These things could be going on in parallel with each other.
Yeah. They. I would think they would be, and I couldn't. I don't have a crystal ball on that, unless a judge approved an injunction of some sort. I would think that the project would move forward. And this fight would go on, as many environmental regulations do. One side or the other file suit, and then it takes years for that to be addressed in the courts.
We'll leave it there for now. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Glad to do it, Rob.
That's Lee Bergquist, reporter who covers environmental issues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about an Illinois lawsuit, a planned lawsuit over air quality standards in southeastern Wisconsin and the possible impact on Foxconn development there. Right now, undocumented immigration and the level of crime that may or may not come with it, it's been one of the most hotly debated political issues of the last few years, driving conversations about a border wall, sanctuary cities, and more. UW researcher recently decided to get a better handle on the question by digging into the numbers, looking at immigration and criminal data across the U.S. from 1990 to 2014. Michael Light is an assistant professor of sociology and Latino Chicano studies at UW-Madison. He conducted the study along with Ty Miller, a PhD student at Purdue University. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Well, what led you to take a look at this, and what wasn't out there that you were trying to figure out?
Sure. So I think you had just mentioned, I think, one of the major issues, and that is that there are considerable debates going on. We're generating policies. We're having lots of very influential conversations about the impact of undocumented immigration on violent crime. However, these conversations are essentially occurring in a vacuum of data. We really didn't have very much information in terms of what are the trends in undocumented immigration, how do they relate to the prevalence of violent crime in society, and so and essentially that was simply just because of data constraints. So up until recently, we really haven't had reliable information on the size of the undocumented population. So only recently do we think we have a better handle on this now. So what we did in this study was we used state-level data. So we have all 50 states from between 1990 and 2014. And we looked at how do the trends in undocumented immigration over this time, how do they impact the level of violent crime in society?
And what data is out there now that we didn't used to have? Why do we have a better handle, we think, on the number of undocumented immigrants in a particular state in this case?
Sure. So in this case, the data that we use come from two different sources. And I would say these are two of the most reliable and also the most widely used and cited sources on the size of the undocumented population. Our two sources come from the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C., and the second source comes from the Center for Migration Studies. I could be happy to go into detail about how they estimate the size of the undocumented population. They have very sort of detailed information about how they estimate this. I think a couple things are important to note, and that is the Department of Homeland Security, to just give you a sense of the reliability of these estimates, the Department of Homeland Security often will use the Pew as their benchmark in terms of, you know, when they try to put out estimates of the size of the undocumented population, they will often use the Pew as sort of the, you know, if we're doing as well as the Pew, I think we're doing okay. So, I mean, we have a pretty good sense that these are fairly reliable.
So you take those numbers of undocumented mm-hmm. immigrants by state, and then you stack them up against violent crime data over that time period. So what kind of things do you find out?
Sure. So the general pattern is fairly clear across many, many different sort of specifications and examinations. And that is that the relationship between undocumented immigration and violent crime. So let me be clear about what violent crime is. So the FBI violent crime index includes several offenses. This would be murder and manslaughter, rape, murder, rape, aggravated assault, and robbery. Those would be the four crimes that make up the violent crime index. And what we find is that increased undocumented immigration is negatively correlated with all of those outcomes. And so what that means is that undocumented immigration goes up, the prevalence of violent crime tends to go down.
Why?
So there's a few reasons for this. So so one of the things that, I mean, I think this is why I think the research is so important. I mean, there are very conflicting ideas about what would be the effect of undocumented immigration on crime. There are good reasons to think that undocumented immigrants could increase crime. So, for example, there's higher rates of poverty, lower rates of educational attainment. All of those things we think could be correlated with increase in crime. However, there's also equally strong reasons on the other side. So, for example, undocumented immigrants have a very strong incentive to avoid running into the criminal justice system in any way, right? So that's a very strong incentive to avoid criminal wrongdoing. The second reason is simply what we refer to as just a selection effect, and that is that undocumented immigrants often come here seeking things like educational opportunities, employment opportunities, and undocumented immigration, in all candor, just requires a tremendous amount of motivation and planning. So to the extent that those characteristics, hard work, motivation, determination, those things tend not to be very highly correlated with having a high criminal propensity. So what that means is that if you have people coming in with low criminal propensities, there means they're not often going to show up in the crime statistics, but they are going to show up in the population. So that's going to decrease the level of prevalence. It's going to decrease the prevalence of violence in society. Sociologist at Harvard University, Robert Sampson, wrote an op-ed a few years ago now entitled "Open Doors Don't Invite Criminals." That's the core idea behind his thesis.
We're talking about undocumented immigration and its link or non-link to violent crime rates in the United States. Michael Light is with us sharing some of his research. He's an assistant professor of sociology and Latino Chicano studies at UW-Madison. Michael, one thing that people might raise is, as you mentioned, if you're here, you're undocumented, you don't want contact with police. Could it be that crimes are underreported for that reason? If they're between two undocumented immigrants themselves, the one doesn't want to report it because they would risk being deported themselves?
So we actually, that's a great question. We've spent a lot of time thinking about this, this issue of what exactly are we seeing? Are we seeing simply less crime or less reporting? So in our analysis, what we looked at is what we, sort of the main analysis looks at reported crimes to the FBI. And it's exactly right. It's you, that our results are what you'd expect if undocumented immigrants were simply not reporting violent crime. Now, I think it is important what you just said, that this would only pertain to people with questionable legal status, right? So, for example, if you're leaving the building today and you get robbed, chances are you're going to report that regardless of who the offender is. So that would get recorded. However, this question of lack of reporting is really important. And so we tried to get at this directly by supplementing our analysis with data from the National Crime Victimization Survey. Now, this is a nationwide representative survey designed explicitly to get at this question. This is what criminologists refer to as the dark figure of crime. And these are crimes that occur that don't get reported to the police. And we know that this is true across populations, that there's a whole swath of crimes that never get reported to the police. And so what we did is we used state-level estimates of the National Crime Victimization Survey to see, does undocumented immigration, does that relationship change, right? Is it actually correlated with less victimization, even if those victimizations are not reported to the police? And what we find is that the relationship is the same. So it doesn't necessarily appear to be the case that it's just decreased reporting.
Another question that might come up is the idea of sanctuary cities. Since this is state-level data, is this granular enough to say, well, maybe the trends are different in a sanctuary city versus the areas around it that don't have sanctuary or sanctuary-like policies? How do you start to dive into that?
Sure. So to your question about is it granular enough, the answer is no. So states are sort of by definition a pretty broad unit of analysis, and so we can't get at, you know, the city level mechanisms or the neighborhood level mechanisms that maybe that you could expect differences, right, between immigration and crime. I will say is that while our study can't speak directly to this issue, there is now a series of studies looking at this issue of sanctuary policies and crime. There's one published in the American Sociological Review by Christopher Lyons and a research team out of the University of New Mexico, I believe. And they looked specifically at this relationship between immigration and violent crime. Now, it wasn't specific to undocumented immigration. They had to look at immigration generally. But what they found is that actually immigration reduced crime actually more in sanctuary cities than in cities that did not have sanctuary policies.
It's actually reducing crime. Is this somehow having an effect on non-immigrant communities already in these places?
Well, what I would say is the research on immigration and crime is actually showing that immigrants, having high proportions of immigrants in your community, is pretty consistently showing that it reduces the level of violent crime. So one thesis behind this is simply that in immigrant communities, there's increased economic revitalization, that many immigrants are very entrepreneurial. They may increase the amount of economic resources, which can be beneficial. Another hypothesis is that there's just higher rates of sort of informal social control in immigrant communities, and that is that there's just more informal monitoring of behavior, and that type of monitoring is useful for regulating criminal behavior. So there is quite a bit of research that suggests that the sort of pro-social benefits of immigration are beneficial not just for immigrants themselves, but for sort of the broader community.
Going beyond the scope of your study a bit, the president and others have raised concerns about undocumented immigrants in particular leading the way in drug smuggling across mm-hmm. borders. So drug crime doesn't fit that violent crime that you are studying in this research. Is there research out there, though, on relations of drug-related crimes to the presence of immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants?
Sure. So actually, we published a study exactly on this topic last year. So let me first acknowledge that the issue of drug smuggling across the U.S.-Mexico border is a reality. I think some of the most recent estimates, I apologize if I get the specific number wrong, but about 90% of, I think, the cocaine in the United States comes across the U.S.-Mexico border. So that actually does happen. But what's important to note is that doesn't necessarily mean that drug smuggling is linked to flows of undocumented immigrants, right? Those aren't necessarily one and the same thing. And so, for example, in a study that we published last year in the American Journal of Public Health, we looked exactly at this issue. We looked at four different indicators of drug and alcohol problems: DUI arrests, DUI deaths, drug arrests, and then drug overdose deaths. And what we found is that increased undocumented immigration was negatively correlated. So that means more undocumented immigration, less of DUI arrests, drug arrests, and drug deaths. And then it had absolutely no relationship between DUI deaths. So there isn't much evidence actually linking undocumented immigration flows to drug or alcohol problems or violent crime now.
Do you see policy implications based on the current study and that study you were just talking about?
Well, I think I am of the opinion, I think policy prescription should be based on what the empirical reality is. And so, ours is not the end all be all of studies, but we are some of the first people out there to actually have some data on this issue. And so, there are debates about undocumented immigration that don't involve issues of public safety. So, you hear sometimes people talk about issues of sovereignty. Our study doesn't speak to that in any way. But what I do think is that the justifications for policy should be rooted in the research. And so if the argument is that we need a border wall to decrease undocumented immigration and increase public safety, I would say there isn't much evidence to suggest that's gonna work. And in fact, we have research suggests that some of our most aggressive immigration enforcement policies haven't increased public safety. So an example would be between 2008 and 2013, we had a very extensive program called the Secure Communities Program, where we dramatically increased the number of deportations for what you would call criminal aliens, so people who come into contact with the criminal justice system. Multiple systematic reviews of this program suggested it had absolutely no relationship between violent crime. So even though deportations went up considerably, violent crime did not go down in any appreciable way.
We'll leave it there for now. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you.
That's Michael Light, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Latino Chicano Studies at UW-Madison. He was with us to break down his research, finding that undocumented immigration doesn't increase violent crime rates. First,
thank you for coming to this show, by the way. I really do appreciate you coming to a thing because you didn't have to. And it's really easy not to go to things. It is so much easier not to do things than to do them that you would do anything is totally remarkable. Percentage-wise, it is 100% easier not to do things than to do them. And so much fun not to do them, especially when you were supposed to do them.
Was comic John Mulaney thanking his audience for showing up. Now, maybe your personal version is more like this. Early in the week, you make plans with friends for a few days later. Then as the week goes on, you're tired, you're a little stressed out, and when it is time to go out, you feel like it would be way better and way easier to just stay at home, maybe with leftovers or takeout and something good to binge watch. So your question then is to bail or not to bail? And then what does it do to our social relationships when it's so easy to cancel our plans to spend time together? We asked Regan Gurung to tackle the social issue of bailing. He's the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joins us now from our studios in Green Bay. Regan, good to have you back.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, let's talk about that feeling, that conflict in the moment. I made these plans, but gosh, it's so tempting just to stay home after that busy day of work. This is something that probably most people go through at some point, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I think in the last few years in particular, you've seen us having more and more to do, and we take on more responsibilities, and there's just so much going on, it seems, that sometimes instead of going out, it does seem easier to just not. And of course, the question is, what are you going to do? Are you going to let down a whole bunch of friends waiting for you? Or are you going to, because of the guilt you may feel, are you going to do it anyway? Well, I think for the most part, at least anecdotally, we see that there are a lot of people who just, press the button, as it were, and cancel on a date or a social event.
It feels like that. And you wrote in a recent blog post, we don't have the empirical evidence to back that up. There hasn't been the vast Pew study on bailing out
exactly.
on plans. But it makes sense in some ways because of our social media technology, our texting. It's really easy to, in a very impersonal way, bail out on our friends or family.
Absolutely. And I think the whole notion is, think back to the times when if you had to cancel something, you would have to actually see the person face to face or make a call. That's a lot it's a lot different situation when you have to pick up the phone and say, oh, by the way, you know that thing we planned for so long? Well, I'm not going to be able to do it. That's a lot harder to do than just, you know, getting onto text messenger or Facebook or something and just sending out a quick, hey, can't do it this time, sorry. And, you know, hopping back so that you don't even hear the expression or the response that the person has. That, I think, is one of the ways technology is making it very easy for us to do those things that otherwise we wouldn't do.
And Regan, I think we've talked about introverts together on the show before, and there's a lot of talk in the culture about people who are introverts. And I, you know, in real life, I am pretty introverted. And I think there's something about being that introvert that makes it especially tough to make that decision. You know, a week ago, I was really outgoing and made this plan. Now that I'm faced with reality, I usually don't bail, but I know that thought process of, it'd be easier to just not summon up the energy to be out there.
Right. Yeah. You know, but and I think you mentioned introversion. And I think, remember, that's just one of those different personality traits that we have. When you think about personality as it's studied psychologically, we often talk about the big five: conscientiousness, agreeableness, extroversion, neuroticism. And introversion definitely can drive behavior. But I think when we talk about canceling, maybe conscientiousness is another trait that we should think about. Maybe it's, you know, if you're a conscientious person, you are not going to back out of things. If you are a conscientious person, you know, you turn in your work when you're supposed to. And I think in this particular case, maybe conscientiousness is the trait that's higher up on that list, together with, I think, one of my favorite things to study and think about, how we cope with stress. You know, I think a lot of what you talked about could be a coping mechanism where we go, I just can't face that stressful situation or, you know, people right now. I just need some time by myself.
Talking to UW Green Bay psychology professor Regan Gurung about the culture and psychology of bailing out on our plans. You've been there probably on one side or the other of this. You've canceled at the last minute or wanted to or been canceled on. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you recently been the bailer or the bailee? Do you think we're getting worse about meeting our obligations, getting out and hanging out with people? And Regan, in your blog post, your advice for people thinking about bailing was don't. And that resonated with me because almost, I would say 99% of the time when I've been in that position, I'm like, maybe I want to bail. I go, I'm glad I went. I had a good time.
Right. Absolutely. And I think it's difficult for us to imagine what a situation will be like. And I think this works in two directions. On one hand, when we make a plan, it's difficult for us to imagine how tired we will be when that day comes along, right? Which is why very often leading up to it, we go, I don't want to do it. On the flip side, it's very hard for us, and we'd have to really cognitively and consciously say to ourselves, hey, you know, let's think about that last time we went out. Wasn't that a good time? And I think that's something that may help, where you think about the good time you had, not how bad you feel at that moment. And honestly, it's like working out. You know, how there are many times I know I don't want to work out or go to the gym or go for a run, and I just make sure I do it. And I tell myself, you know what? Don't even think about it. Go do it. Let's touch base in 10 minutes. And sure enough, once I'm at the place or on a run, you know, I go, I'm sort of glad I did this. So, and I think that applies with events and meetings. Just go out and do it. And for the most part, I think we'll be glad that we did.
Getting back to the technology side of things, Regan, another temptation here is that we have a lot of information and entertainment at our fingertips at home. Even if you don't have a fancy TV system, you can watch infinite amounts of stuff just with your phone. The stay home option gets more alluring with all those options, right?
Right. And I think it's not only the technology exposing us to multiple options of what we can do staying home. It's actually also exposing us to many things that we can do that night instead of meeting those people that we were going to meet. You know, so especially Facebook is one of those things where something will pop up and say, hey, all your friends are interested in going to this event. And you go, oh, I didn't even think of that event. And, you know, you look at it and you go, ooh, but I made plans to go someplace else. Well, that event, if it's pretty appealing, you may just change plans right there. And so I think that's something we don't think about. Whenever people miss meetings, it's not always because they want to grab some solo time and, you know, catch up on Netflix. Sometimes something better's come up. And I think that makes for even more interesting situations when you learn that somebody who canceled with you actually went and did something else.
I want to put this in the context of some kind of serious stuff out there. First of all, stress. You mentioned a lot of us are feeling stressed, and there's research that suggests that we are getting, if I have this right, more stressed over time. Is that true?
Yeah. So every year, the American Psychological Association does what they call the Stress in America survey. And they've been doing it for quite a number of years now. And every year, it doesn't look great. And when you look at the most recent numbers that I could pull out, 75% of Americans report experiencing at least one stress symptom in the last month. When you think about the percent of Americans who lie awake at night, well, 45% apparently report lying awake at night. 36% report being nervous or anxious. Those are some pretty high numbers. And when you look back at that same survey every year, you can see that those numbers are higher than it has been for some time. So I think, you know, when we think about canceling, you know, when we think about why did that person cancel, we could should probably also think about maybe that person is taking the right step in doing something that'll help them cope with just a really busy week. And so even when, you know, yes, I would still say if possible, don't bail. And the reason for that is actually hanging out with people is social support and could help you cope with stress. I think we also can recognize that there will be some times when perhaps the best thing to do is just take some time for yourself. I think the issue becomes, you know, is this something that's happening very frequently? And if it is happening frequently, it could just be because you're under a lot of stress or because, you know, maybe you're not weighing or thinking about all the things going on in the best way. So that level of self-reflectiveness and self-knowledge becomes pretty important.
Regan Gurung is with us talking about why we are prone to cancel plans, why it's tempting to cancel plans with other people, why we hate it when other people do it to us. He's a professor of human development and psychology at UW Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you on either side of the equation? Do you find yourself canceling those plans with friends more often now than you used to? What's usually the reason that you want to get out of doing something? Does it feel more acceptable today to bail on friends than it used to be? Or have you been on the other side of things? Have you been bailed on? How does that make you feel? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Regan Gurung about why it can be so tempting to bail on our social plans, even sometimes if we're the ones who arranged it. He's a professor of human development and psychology at UW Green Bay, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Technology has made it easier to make plans with friends in some cases. Has it made it too easy to break those plans? If you could just text instead of calling or telling someone in person, does that make it seem not as bad? Do you bail out on plans often? Do people bail on you? How does that make you feel? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Matt is with us in Madison. Matt, hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was just going to mention that I had an instance last summer where my phone broke, and it was on a Thursday or a Friday. I went the weekend without it, and I found it to be so enjoyable that I went about a month. Now, I don't have a traditional job, so I was able to do that. And I was telling the gal that took my call in the first place that a side effect, well, first of all, I was able to manage my planning of things because I was using my wife's phone to contact my friends. And they were contacting me through her. She got sick of it. But I found it to be very relaxing because I didn't have to deal with as many people. But an interesting side effect was I'm certain that I became more curious and more interested in learning about anything, not in just specifics, but just my mind through the lack of distraction just opened up to wanting to be more creative and learn more stuff. And since I got my phone back, that has
all gone.
Matt, thanks a lot. Yeah, and so the technology versus, I guess, everything else in the world, Regan, but that including our social connections.
Right. And, you know, Matt puts this, actually reminds me of a study I read where they tested people on a learning task, and the individuals either had their phone on the table in front of them, in their bags, or in another room. And in all three cases, the phones were off. Yet the people who had their phones on their desk next to them did the worst on this learning task. So I think Matt nicely, you know, mentions how that those phones can be distractions. They occupy our minds. And, you know, especially when somebody texts you to do something and you're in the middle of something else, you're going to be tempted to drop what you're doing to respond to that. Yeah, I can do it or I cannot do it. So it really raises the ante a lot.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Alex with us in Appleton. Alex, hi.
Hi. So I heard you talking about how going out into a social context can be a support system for someone that might be struggling with stress. And so my question is, what sort of obligation do the people that are part of that social outing have to be supportive of someone that would frequently cancel and occasionally show up versus just in the future not continuing to invite them to social gatherings because they are as someone that has been flaky or frequently someone that cancels?
Alex, thanks. The chronic canceller, do we have to keep inviting them, Regan?
You know, so this nicely gets at the situational versus or short-term versus long-term, right? When we talk about, I mentioned conscientiousness earlier on, when we talk about personality, I think it's important to separate out personality factors from situational factors. So, for example, if you are, to use the word flaky, and that's a personality trait, where in general you tend to do this in many things, I think friends are less likely, and rightly, less likely to cut you some slack. On the flip side, something important for all of us when we have somebody cancel something is to think about the situation. Was there a situation that made that person cancel that event? And maybe there was something or is something going on that's very different in that person's life that we do need to pay attention to. Now, if that happens frequently, you can understand why that person will not be invited back. And, you know, that makes sense. But I think separating out the personality from the situational factors is a pretty big deal.
Alex, thanks a lot for that call. My worry, I guess, Regan, would be, you know, what if that person is dealing with depression and that might be something that's leading them to cancel their plans? Maybe instead of cutting them out, maybe you have like a lower risk scenario. It's like, hey, I'm going out for lunch one way or the other, whether you're there or not. Stop by if you can. And then if the bailing, you've kept the lines of communication open. If the bailing happens, you're not out anything.
Robin, I'll take you a step further. I think if we really care about our friends and there's a friend who is consistently bailing, I think a good friend reaches out to that friend and says, hey, I've noticed you've been bailing often. Anything going on? Can we chat? Can we meet someplace else? I don't think we just let it be, but I think that's we owe it to our friends to go in and find out what's going on.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Kate on the line in Racine. Kate, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I work in the area of groups that are committed to coming to different occasions, somewhat like direct sales, but I'm in wellness, and I've also been in direct sales. And the thing that we talk about when working with women is that they're very committed, they're excited to come to whatever workshop you have, they've planned it, and then at the last minute, you know, 50% to 75% of your women will cancel. And I'm wondering if there's this element of not feeling significant enough, like, oh, there's going to be all other kinds of people there, she doesn't need me there, you know what I mean? So that in group, you know, the sociology of groups, that I'm not significant enough, there'll be enough people there. Does that ring true? I don't think they're really being, you know, not being conscientious. I just don't think they feel that they matter.
Gotcha,
and from,
Kate.
My perspective, it's kind of disappointing when, you know, that your clientele just everybody calls because they're busy or whatever. What do you think?
So nobody's going to miss me if I don't show up, Regan.
Right. And in psychology, there's a phenomenon called the diffusion of responsibility. And that's exactly, Kate, what I think you're talking about here is when you're in a group and you know there are a lot of other people, you know that if you pulled out, there'd still be other people there. So it really won't make that much of a difference. And I think you often see this when you're in a group Snapchat or a group Facebook Messenger and there's an event planned. If there are a number of people on that group, it actually is likely to increase the likelihood that somebody will say no and drop out because they know there are other people on that group and in theory the show will go on.
Kate, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at UW Green Bay, talking about the psychology and culture of bailing out, canceling those plans with friends and family, maybe at the last minute. Regan, I want to put this in the context of some more recent research we've been seeing in headlines. Increases in loneliness in the United States, especially for younger generations. The millennials, I think, in particular, saw high rates of loneliness. Is that the flip side of this bailing out coin?
Well, I think what we are seeing, and this is research that came out with Gene Twenge in the iGeneration book that came out a couple months ago, and it clearly shows that over time, the percent of 8th to 12th graders that rate themselves as being lonely is significantly higher than it was even 10 years ago. Now, that is correlated or associated with a higher use of technology, right? And remember, I said correlated here. So I think, and not, you know, one causing the other, although it could, but I think in this particular case, that's probably happening. There's a possibility that that's linked as well, where you have these personal feelings of loneliness that are increasing that may make it more difficult to want to be out with other people.
Let's bring on another caller now. Lynn is with us in Eau Claire. Lynn, hi.
Hi, Rob. This is fascinating, and I'm wondering if there was any consideration taken in the study between rural and metropolitan folks and their attitude toward putting you off, I guess.
And have you had an experience one way or the other?
Yes. I come from the Chicago. I spent the first half of my life in the Chicago area, and now I'm in Eau Claire. And it just, to me, folks up here, I've just a lot more. It's just like you just take it for granted that you don't make plans because somebody's going to bail.
In Eau Claire, more so than Chicago, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Lynn,
thanks for the call. And Regan, we're not working mainly with a study. I don't know if anybody's broken this down yet, but any thoughts on how things might work in one area versus another?
Yeah, you know, there are different norms for different places. And I think, you know, it's possible that there are norms for the city, you know, this is how it is, and as Lynn mentioned, there are different norms for where you are. I think, I'm not sure we can break it down by rural versus urban. I would bet it's more part of the country, the state that you're in, whether it's the north versus the south, where I think the norms and the social norms for respectful behavior with each other is going to be different.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Regan, what's your advice for people maybe facing that situation, let's say, this weekend?
You know, I'd actually say the biggest thing to watch for is a natural human tendency we have to blame cancellations on the person if it's somebody else, but blame it on the situation if it's us. So if I canceled something, I go, obviously I had something going on, or it's, you know, it's, yeah, there's something going on. But if somebody else canceled it, we tend to say, oh, it's that person who's flaky. And, you know, in psychology, we call that the fundamental attribution error. Let's not make that error because it'll help us treat people better if we don't.
So we impose the best motives on ourselves
exactly.
And the worst motives
exactly.
On everybody around us.
Exactly.
Regan, always good to talk to you. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of human development and psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us from our studios in Green Bay to talk about why we are prone to cancel our plans with others, sometimes even at the last minute, and why it bugs us when other people do it to us. One reason there, we often think the best of ourselves and maybe the worst of other people. There is still time for you to share your thoughts. You can still join the conversation over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know. Have you caught yourself bailing out on those social events, whether it's just to hang out with a friend, go to the birthday party, catch your friend's band playing, whatever? Are you more likely to get out of that than you used to? Or have you made a concerted effort to get out and hang out with people? Or do you feel like generally in our culture, people are bailing out more? Is technology to blame? How? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Bill,
what?
Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
That's Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter as Bill and Ted in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure from 1989. one of the defining movies of my generation, sort of. There was a sequel to the time-traveling comedy adventure that was Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, and now they're coming back again with the original stars. The Hollywood Reporter reports that Reeves and Winter are signed on for Bill and Ted Face the Music. They will once again play Ted Theodore Logan and Bill S. Preston Esquire, would-be rock musicians with a key role to play in the destiny of humankind. And to answer your first question, no, they will not be cast as the teenage versions of themselves. That'd be hard to pull off. Both actors are in their mid-50s. In the original movie, Bill and Ted traveled through time to learn what they needed to know to create a great presentation for their history class and keep their band, Wild Stallions, together. In the new movie, they play their middle-aged selves, but they still haven't created the music that's supposed to change the world. Time travel presumably ensues. The movie is in pre-production, and there's no release date yet, so unless you can time travel, you're just going to have to wait. In the meantime, be excellent to each other and party on. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.